All right.
Get some older car in.
Let's look at the. Okay, guys. Why don't we all look at the minutes? Oh, yeah, I think we did. The wrestling bond will move the minutes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move the minutes of the February 25th meeting of the Subcommittee on Licensing of the Health and Human Services Committee.
Those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Okay. The minutes then move and pass. Okay. Representative Simon. What bill do you have? 2747, I take it?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Representative Murphy, you want to move this? Would anyone in here want to move this? No, I'll do it.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move House File 2747 for consideration.
Okay, Representative Murphy moves 2747. And I believe there's an author's amendment.
There is, but Mr. Chair, with your indulgence, I'd like to take the unconventional step of not introducing the author's amendment right away. There's a reason for that that I can explain, but if that's okay with you.
Okay.
Okay.
Well, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I appreciate your time. I know time is short. Members, the reason for the introduction of this bill is to save the state of Minnesota a whole lot of money and time and aggravation. If we pass this bill, there's a very good chance that a lawsuit will go away. And I know that because I've been talking to the attorneys and the various stakeholders in this lawsuit. And the lawsuit is about the provision that this bill seeks to amend. The bill as introduced, and this is why, Mr. Chair, I'm not discussing right away the author's amendment. The bill as introduced really, in sum and substance, gets rid of three words. On line 2.6, it gets rid of the words or former client. There's also the change there from patient to client, but that's window dressing. Really, the sum and substance of the bill as introduced is getting rid of the word or former client. Why? Because under this provision of the law, this law does what very few, if any, laws in all of the Minnesota statutes do. What this law does is it makes it it declares improper conduct sexual contact between the person mentioned in the statute, a complementary and alternative health care practitioner, and a client after the relationship. And this is why there's currently a lawsuit pending against the state of Minnesota. In my opinion, in the opinion of many other people, they're going to win that lawsuit. And at the end of that lawsuit, we will spend a lot of time and money and attention, and we will probably lose, we, the state of Minnesota. The reason is that in almost no other circumstances in state law do we regulate sexual contact after the relationship. I am a member of the bar. I'm a lawyer. Lawyers can't have sexual contact with current clients. There are other professions, licensed or unlicensed, where you can't have sexual contact with current clients. But in almost nowhere else or in any other state is there regulation as to what happens when there's no longer a professional relationship. And, you know, the litigants here, the plaintiffs, are basically urging that this law be tossed out. They probably have a pretty good shot, I think. And we can make this lawsuit either substantially or completely go away by getting rid of something that I personally am not so sure we need at all. I don't know, and I think this, frankly, I would hope, I'm in your hands, members, but I would imagine this cuts across ideologies as well. I mean, I would imagine for the conservatives among you, you don't necessarily want the so-called nanny state monitoring people's romantic and sex lives after the relationship. I want to stress that, after the relationship. Not during, where we prohibit lawyers, doctors, others licensed and unlicensed from having a relationship, but for a period of 2 years afterwards, according to this statute, somehow we're supposed to be monitoring whether people are having romantic involvement with someone after there's a professional relationship. It's over, it's done with. And so that's what the bill's about. The author's amendment would, if the committee was so inclined, go further and almost surely get rid of the lawsuit entirely. What it would do is, if you were so inclined, it would also get rid of lines, at the end of line 2.8 through 2.11, In other words, it would get rid of this whole business of former client altogether. And then it would also address another portion of the lawsuit, which I confess kind of puzzles me too, and you'll hear from an attorney here in a minute, the testifier. But members, I don't know if you look at sub Q on page 3, and you're all experts in this area. I don't serve on the committee, but I am trying, and I know the litigants in this case are trying to figure out what does it mean to engage in a professional relationship with a complementary and alternative health care client in which the objectivity of the unlicensed complementary and alternative health care practitioner would be impaired. This case, this lawsuit, arises out of a massage therapist, and you'll hear the facts shortly. And I think part of the nub of the lawsuit here, as you'll hear, is what does it mean for a massage therapist to lose his or her objectivity? And I don't want to be too hip or cute about it, but I mean, we're trying to figure out what that really means, and is that at all enforceable? Is that something that would give anyone of us or our families or our friends any guidance as to what's expected there? So before we act or even propose any action on the author's amendment, I think, members and Mr. Chair, you might benefit from hearing from one of the lawyers involved in the case who can describe a lot better than I can the circumstances.
Sure. Why don't we go ahead with that? I do have a couple of questions, too. Go ahead.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Mark Johnson. I'm an attorney at the law firm of Green Apple. And as Mr. Simon pointed out, my firm has been for about the past year representing Larae Fielman, who is a massage therapist in Lindstrom, Minnesota, who was investigated and disciplined under the statute as it's currently written. I'll tell you a little bit about the case. I'll give you some of my observations on the statute in action, and I'll share some thoughts on the proposed amendment. Can everybody hear me okay?
Mm-hmm.
Thank you. As I said, Mrs. Fielman is a massage therapist in Lindstrom, Minnesota, which, as many of you may know, is a town of about 3,000 people. Beginning in October 2000 and ending in April 2002, she provided massage therapy services to a gentleman named Kirk Fielman. They had absolutely no sexual relationship during that entire time. A few months after the last massage therapy appointment, Mrs. Fielman, then not Mrs. Fielman, and Mr. Fielman began dating. They became engaged in March 2003. They got married in September 2003. Several months after they were married, Mrs. Fielman learned from the Department of Health that her relationship with her husband was under investigation. She had been reported for having a, quote, unethical, inappropriate relationship with a former client. Again, mind you, after the end of the therapeutic relationship. The Department of Health subjected Mrs. Fielman to an extensive psychological evaluation at Mrs. Fielman's own expense. She was subjected to a tape recorded interview with interrogators, I should say, from the Department of Health, including extensive questioning about her sexual relationship with her husband. Despite the psychological evaluation coming back completely clean, the psychologist determined that Mrs. Fielman posed no threat to the public. The Department of Health proceeded to initiate disciplinary action against Mrs. Fielman. She ran up more than $10,000 in legal bills fighting that, and really fighting for her right to practice and her right to have sex with her own husband. During the course of all that, Mr. and Mrs. Fielman were publicly humiliated. Their names were spread around the press. If you ever Google Larae Fielman, you'll find thousands of hits because it's a celebrated, somewhat notorious case that I don't think has made Minnesota look particularly good. Mrs. Fielman, among other things, opened a new clinic in Wisconsin, so she now has two sets of bills to pay. All in order to try to make sure she continued making a living, even if she lost her right to practice here in Minnesota. Eventually, the department ordered her to pay a monetary fine, but when we notified the department of her intent to appeal, the department dropped the fine, dropped the entire disciplinary action. Ultimately, subsequently, the department did reimburse Mrs. Fielman for about $6,000 worth of the legal fees that she had run up before my firm took the case on a pro bono basis. The bill before you would go a long way toward assuring that other Minnesotans are not subjected to this kind of investigation and discipline for exercising their basic right to engage in sexual relationships that are not commercial in nature, that are private, consensual, with adults, and that have that post-date the professional relationship that I think is the core of what this statute is interested in. I think it's important to note that the bill would not undermine the ability of the department to investigate and discipline therapists who engage in sexual activity with current clients. And in that sense, it would bring the statute in line with ethical standards set forth by a number of organizations of complementary and healthcare, alternative healthcare practitioners, including the Associated Body Work and Massage Professionals, which has provided a letter in support of this bill, which I believe has become part of the record. I would point out there's also a Minnesota organization called the Minnesota Touch Movement Network, which sets forth on its internet site an ethical code that addresses the need for massage therapists to avoid sexual relationships with current clients, but it's important to note makes no mention of such relationships with former clients. This bill would bring the rules governing massage therapists and other alternative healthcare practitioners in line with the rules that govern other similarly situated practitioners, such as chiropractors. In the case of chiropractors, under Minnesota Statute 148.10, they are not prohibited by statute from engaging in sexual conduct with former clients, only with current clients. And that's really the heart of what we're hoping to accomplish with this legislation. Mr. Simon mentioned, and I should say also with the lawsuit, Mr. Simon also mentioned Subdivision Q, the impaired objectivity prohibition. I don't think that the term impaired objectivity is one that's well understood within the field of massage therapy. It isn't defined in the statute. It isn't at all clear to me what does and does not constitute a violation of Subdivision Q. The Department of Health, in the course of the proceedings against Mrs. Spielman, took the position that Subdivision Q was violated by Mrs. Spielman's accepting tips, exchanging small gifts with clients, and socializing with clients outside the therapeutic relationship. That came as somewhat of a surprise to Mrs. Spielman, who, like I said, lives in a town of 3,000 people. She knows most of her clients. She's acquainted with them outside of the professional relationship. So I would just finish by saying I would urge the committee to consider eliminating Subdivision Q and getting the Department of Health out of the business of policing the private lives of folks who are no longer engaged in any kind of a professional relationship together.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. And Representative Simon, I'm not too familiar with this this piece as well, but I assume it was probably put in place to prevent prostitution. I assume that might be the case, and I know that your client, Mr. Johnson, was not part of that, but you guys have an idea of what this provision was tied there for?
Mr. Chairman, I can speculate some. I have reviewed some of the legislative history in the past. I don't have it here with me. I do think that that was one of the purposes to prevent, you know, paid for sex, to prevent these kind of therapeutic relationships from turning into a front for something other than what they should be. However, I would point out that a provision that prevents sex with a current client would have that same impact. And I would also point out there are a number of other statutes that make it illegal to engage in prostitution. And in the statute as it's currently written, if one is convicted of violations of various crimes against the person, including sexual violations, that alone can be a ground for losing your right to practice in Minnesota and for fines under the statute. So I think that there are other ways to get at that concern that are already accomplished without the former client language present in the statute.
Mr. Johnson and Representative Simon, I'm not a lawyer, as you could tell. I do have some concerns. If we go ahead with your proposal, is that going to open up, undo the intent of this proposal, which is to prevent prostitution or to pay for sex in this So I do have these kind of concerns. I don't know if anyone else on the committee, I don't know, is a lawyer and might be able to.
Mr. Chair, if I may, I all I can say is that what Mr. Johnson just said seems to make sense to me, which, and I don't think this is a lawyer thing. I don't think it has really anything to do with that. Anybody can make a decision on this. I think that, you know, the current laws that are in place right now as to act, as to conduct with a current client, those would still be left untouched and would presumably get at prostitution. If a massage therapist or an acupuncturist or anyone else covered under this section had a sexual relationship with a current client, that would seem to be covered right now, and we're not seeking to touch that. It's just the issue of policing something for 2 years into the future after the termination of any professional relationship, whatever the nature of that relationship, seems a bit much, and the lawyers who have looked at this tell me that they think that the state's going to lose. And so, from a practical standpoint, you know, there's a pending lawsuit right now, and passing this bill will go a long way towards, and may completely, get rid of this lawsuit. So from my standpoint, it seems like we have enough safeguards in place. I wish I knew more about the legislative history to know why this was put in here, Mr. Chair. I don't. But I think we have enough protections as to prostitution. You'll see, I hope it's been passed out, the ABMP letter of support here, members, that you have from one of the national organizations as well.
Mr. Chair, could I say one more thing to address your question? One of the things that occurred to me from reviewing the legislative history, I believe initially the legislature was looking at a law that was actually quite similar to what's being proposed now. My understanding or my review of the legislative history suggests that a lot of the language that's present in the statute here was lifted out of statutes that govern psychologists, chemical abuse counselors, individuals who have a very intense personal and psychological relationship where there are issues of transference and a lot of other things that I, as a lawyer, don't fully understand, but things that don't seem to be present to the same degree in a massage therapy or any of the other. I should point out this isn't just massage therapists. If you look at the definitions in the statute, it covers a whole range of alternative and complementary health care practices beyond massage therapy. And I think that the concern had to do with things that aren't really present in these relationships to the same degree that they are in a relationship between a client and a psychologist, a therapist, a mental health variety, if that's helpful to responding to your question, sir.
Maybe just get some more clarification. This bill doesn't undo all of that. It's just referring to massage therapists. So what are some other groups that we're also undoing this part for?
Aromatherapists. It's a list of, I'm not sure if I have it with me, sir, but it's a list of about 20 different. You haven't had it?
No.
I apologize, I didn't bring that with me, sir, but if you take a look at the list, it includes Qigong energy healing.
We'll get staff on this page. Do you have the list of
146A02
that might be involved with?
Mr. Chair, I do. It's in subdivision 4, 146A.01. It is a list of 22 professions, folk practices, healing practices, utilizing food supplements, nutrients, physical forces of heat, cold, and touch, healing touch. These are just some of them. Herbology, homeopathy, naturopathy, body work, massage therapy, meditation, traditional oriental practices.
Okay. I would suggest, Mr. Chair, that as we go down the list, it starts to feel farther and farther afield. The statutory prohibition on sex with the therapist 2 years after the end of the therapeutic relationship only makes less and less sense as we run down the list of practitioners covered by the statute. And I should just finally point out, sir, that, you know, the U.S. Supreme Court has made very clear that individuals have a right to engage in private sexual relationships with persons of their choosing that are not commercial in nature, and that right only becomes stronger when applied to married couples. The case that I've been dealing with for the last year involved a couple that was married and who were, by the Department of Health, continuing to violate the statute by engaging in sex in their marriage. So I do think that the statute goes much farther than it needs to go to cure the prostitution concerns that you've raised, and it goes so far as to traipse into unconstitutional territory, in my view.
Okay. Representative Blunt, did you have a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have a comment and then a clarification. The comment side, I'm just amazed this went through originally in the form it did and it created this problem for your clients. Very unfortunate. But on the clarification side is when they ask if you mentioned how in law and other areas there's a two-year wait. It's not clear to me from what you said whether there's like zero in both the chiropractic reference and all this. My understanding, and that's okay with me, is that there's, you know, as long as they're no longer a client, that's all that's required. Is that correct? There's no two-year window in this case.
Mr. Jackson?
That is true in the case of chiropractors. I've reviewed a number of the different statutes that, you know, cover these kinds of issues as to different healthcare providers. And if you look at it on a spectrum, on one side of the spectrum you have psychologists, chemical abuse counselors, people along those lines where there really are these issues of people irresistibly becoming attracted to their counselor and very significant likelihood of that being taken advantage of. That's on one side of the spectrum, and those often do have a long waiting period or a total prohibition.
Mm-hmm.
On the opposite end of the spectrum are things like chiropractors and I think massage therapists and other complementary and alternative health care providers ought to fit on that end of the spectrum.
With no waiting period.
With no waiting period, that's correct.
In this particular instance, with these kinds of non-trends, I support that. But thank you.
Very good.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess on first blush, it was almost laughable what is happening. Sad. It's not laughable. It's sad. But, and so I think we do need to do something. I guess after having heard Representative Powell's comments, however, it does raise the question, particularly in the area of massage therapy, that if you... I could see it being abused, and that you go in, you pay for your massage, you're considered discharged the minute you walk out the door, you're no longer a client, and then the activity could take place an hour later, and you can say, well, it's not a client any longer. And so I wouldn't have even thought of that if Representative Powell hadn't raised that point of the area of prostitution, where if there is no timeline, it almost could encourage that type of activity to happen. And so I guess I wonder if there was any thought given to some sort of reasonable timeline so that it took it out of the day or the week or the month to make it a little safer so that we don't have the prostitution issue in question.
Mr. Chairman, I guess I would suggest, I think the Department of Health would see right through that. If somebody showed up and said, you know, I paid for my massage, sure, but that was an hour ago. I'm no longer a client. We're just having sex. I think that the Department of Health would see straight through that and, you know, even under the statute without the waiting period, I would certainly think that there'd be a reasonable argument to be made that, look, you're just trying to obey the law. This really is just prostitution, which is illegal under this and 50 other laws. So I see the concern. I don't think that a prohibition or a specific time period is necessary to address the concern if, in fact, people are paying for sex. That's illegal. And I think that, you know, to the extent that there was a concern that the statute needed to do something more explicit to address that, perhaps it could say it is, you know, a violation of this statute to pay for sex, something closer to that. But going into people's truly non-commercial private lives months and months, years, even after they've been married, goes so far beyond anything that really makes sense with the concerns that animated this original legislation. I just don't think it makes sense.
Mr. Chair, I would go even further than Mr. Johnson. I would say not only would the Department of Health see through that, I think the police would see through that. My understanding of the prostitution statute, and we might want to look it up now, I don't know, I can't quote chapter and verse, is that paying for sex, there's no timeline on that, or there may be one that's a matter of many years. But if a person were to pay someone and then 6 months later get what they paid for, that's prostitution. Whether it's 6 months later, 8 months later, a year later, I think a number of years later. So I think that would catch them. And moreover, Mr. Chair and members, I would say this. If we pass this bill and the office amendment, you could still get them under line 1.20, which is conviction of any crime against a person. So I think the cops would see through the one-hour bit. I think they'd see through the one-week bit and the one-month bit. And then once there was a conviction for prostitution under the criminal laws, then you could still get them out of the profession by reference to subdivision 1B on line 1.20, because it's still a crime. The question is whether, in terms of the Department of Health purview, they should be sort of the romance police. And after a relationship has ended, should they be doing that, or should we leave it to law enforcement to look at to see whether any criminal laws are broken? So this isn't a free pass for prostitution at all. The cops would still never buy that. Well, this isn't prostitution. This is just the delayed massage or something like that. I don't think that would happen. I think it's very unlikely.
Representative
Bunn? Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm responding to Representative Norton. Given that the chiropractors have this kind of, only existing client type thing, I think the massage therapists have been stigmatized too long by this history, and that they're a very legitimate profession. I used to go see Sister Rosalyn for my massages, and so she did a great deal to convince the public in Minnesota that was a legitimate non-sex business profession, and I think we should support them in that effort to discontinue that stigmatization by treating them like we would a chiropractor if that's what's being done. So.
I do support this provision as well, but this is we scheduled this so soon, and I didn't have the time to dig deeper, and so I go ahead, Representative.
Well, I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, I didn't mean to interrupt. If that's the case, and it's true, and thank you for indulging me on short notice here, I thought with the committee deadlines I'd want to sort of get in line. But if it's the will of the committee and its members to lay this over and think about it, I mean, certainly we don't want to get in the way of that if, of course, there will be another hearing, if we're not just being shown the door. But this was not meant to be a rush to make people make a rash decision. If you think thinking about it would benefit all of you, then we're at your mercy here. So.
And, Mr. Chair, I'd be glad to be available again to the extent it's helpful to the committee.
Members, Representative Simon, this is probably going to be our last meeting. And I think if we do move this forward, I think I want to reserve the rights of the committee to call this back if any members on the committee have concerns to work on it more. And so,
Mr. Chair.
Chair, thank you. Where's the next stop to this bill?
I believe this is probably going to go to Health Human Service Policy, and then after that it might be just to the floor. Oh, public safety. So it does have a long ways to go. So I think going to public safety, I do feel comfortable because we're not experts in the crime area. So,
right, Mr. Chair, that was my point. If it's going to public safety, a lot of these concerns can be addressed there as well.
I think so. Yeah. Representative Vaughn, did you have any? Okay. Did you want Representative Simon? Did you want to do your amendments, or
I think that it's okay with you, Mr. Chair. If someone could move the
Representative Murphy.
Mr. Chair, I would like to move the H2747A1.
And now, just recap, explain to us that your amendment is doing the bill.
Sure. Thanks, Mr. Chair. What this would do is, excuse me, on line 2.8, starting with that last word of the line 4, it would just get rid of that sentence which ends at line 2.11. It would get rid of the whole idea of the sort of former client business. And then the only other thing it would do is on the next page, 3.8, it would get rid of that paragraph Q and then renumber or re-letter, I guess, the subsequent paragraph, because that's a point of contention in the lawsuit as well, because that language doesn't really give any guidance as to what a person is supposed to do.
All right. Why don't we take a vote on this amendment? And since this is the author's amendment, I think we should put the amendment on, and then we'll send it to public safety. So all those in favor of the amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay. Amendment is adopted. Here's what I think we should do. I think we should move this forward. And I think Representative Bunn had a very good comment about the massage therapy profession being stigmatized. And our committee is strictly on that, and I think if we move this forward to the public safety, and once it gets to public safety, I think a lot of this will get hashed out by those the folks with more expertise in that area. So, I with that, do you have additional comments for anyone? I'm sorry. I see we have another testifier. Ma'am, you step to the podium and state your name for the record. And then if there's anyone else who also wants to testify on this bill, we could let us know. Go ahead, ma'am. State your name for the record.
Thank you. My name is Barbara York. I'm the president of the Minnesota Therapeutic Massage Network, which also includes touch therapists, body workers, and movement educators. I'd ask that you consider not moving this amendment forward. We have a society that has fuzzy boundaries, and because of that, unfortunately, a case was brought to the health department, filed, unfortunately, more out of malice than out of true concern for the consumer, and therefore, the media picked up on it and it was quite exciting. But this is not standard practice, and unfortunately, it should never have gone to court. To amend this bill to take care of that problem removes a great protection for the consumer. The reason it says 2 years is that we have ongoing relationships with our clients, and that whether it's an acupuncturist or a chiropractor or an aromatherapist or a massage therapist, the idea is to remain in an objective relationship where the concern of the client is greater than the interest of the practitioner. The comments about prostitution, it isn't about whether a person has sex with them. It is a tool for the police in the sense that you cannot date a client for over 2 years, or for up to 2 years. This language was based on the unlicensed mental health care practitioner's language. And that's why the 2 years was put in there, because it creates a clear line of what is going to be considered a client and a former client, so that you can't get into that confusion, the erosion of boundaries that is so often, whether you're clergy, whether you're a chiropractor, whether all these fields that include this type of intimate relationship where it's one-on-one and the practitioner has the upper hand. There are many people in many professions who have met, dated, married a client. That is not what this is about. This is about protecting the consumer from that seductive erosion where the flattery, the care, all that transference that happens that takes the objectivity of the relationship out of that practice. So I ask that you not pass this on as a consideration. It is a strength of this complementary and alternative health bill that incorporates whether you're a yoga practitioner or a craniosacral practitioner, a massage therapist. It doesn't matter. It's all the same issue of proper conduct, and that's why it encompasses so much. Because regardless of what you practice, what your education is, and how you go about it, there's a commonality of what conduct is appropriate with the consumer of this state.
Question? Pastor Murphy?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. York, were you involved in the development of the legislation?
Yes, I was.
Mr. Chairman, Ms. York, how was the number 2 years determined? And I ask because I think if we're talking about boundaries and timelines, I'm wondering why it wasn't contemplated that there should never be a relationship once you've engaged in a therapeutic relationship. The 2 years seems arbitrary from my perspective, as arbitrary as a week or a day.
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, again, this was based upon the unlicensed mental health practitioners statute. It is common. I've listed on the piece that was given to you several other positions where this is also stated. 2 years seems to be an ideal period of time where you basically, I wouldn't know that much. I just had a client return to me today after 2 years. Her circumstances have changed entirely. I had to learn anew where she was in her health. And so a year from now, I will remember that. 2 years from now, if I haven't seen her, and if I have the love of my life walk in the door, I have the option to say, at that time, I cannot serve you as a client. If I do decide to pursue this person or a male practitioner pursued, they are at risk of that prohibitive conduct if they're playing games. But we know that people have married in all sorts of professions.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess I will say that I am concerned about what seems like an arbitrary time frame and am bolstered by the notion that a professional would establish for themselves professional boundaries, and that would be different than the conduct that has been described as prostitution, which would be conduct unbecoming to the professional. I'm not convinced about the 2 year time frame. Thank you.
Representative Bunch.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm seeking further clarification from either the testifiers or from our House research staff. I thought I heard earlier that the chiropractors had zero time frame for its only former clients. My understanding from House staff also is that other than the mental health or social work areas, that is typically commonly the case, that it's only former clients. There's not a time frame other than some areas in which there is known to be issues of transference and a close counseling relationship. So I just wanted to seek clarification on that if I'm wrong in my understanding about chiropractors and some of the other areas that are non-mental health or social work.
Mr. Chair, may I respond to that?
Sure, Mr. Johnson.
I believe it's 140. Tell you, I've got it written down here. The statute that governs, my understanding is that the statute that governs chiropractors has no waiting period. So, in the as Ms. York described, if the love of the life walks in, one can end the professional relationship and move forward with a completely different relationship. The notion that one should, you know, but if the concern is people going back and forth, well, then it is a current client. If somebody has never formed, you know, ended the professional relationship, if it's sort of this ongoing back and forth, I might be back in a few weeks, but let's say I'm not your client anymore, I think that's addressed by the statute without the former client provision.
Rips and buns.
Mr. Chair, do we know what the answer is? And I know someone from there is in the room for physical therapy. For physical therapists, what their own professional standard, they're not included among the 22, so do we know what the case is with physical therapists?
To the best of my knowledge, and I don't have the statute in front of me, so I apologize, but to the best of my knowledge, it's a similar provision as it is for chiropractic. I've looked at the statutes and my understanding.
Can someone in the room confirm that? Yes, you're correct. Thank you very much for confirming that. Okay.
Very good. Ms. York.
If I may answer to that, the 2 years gives an idea of what is a former client. If you wanted to have a terminology of what is a former client, the arbitrary sense of just declaring them a former client is still a problem. And I think if you look at the chiropractic field, that you'll find that they do have problems with that, the fact that they don't have a clear line of when do they become a former client. And that is why this has a strength in it, because there is no confusion.
Mr. York, how many people have been brought how many people have been charged with this provision?
As I understand, one.
Just that one. Okay.
Mr. Chairman, may I make one other
Mr.
comment?
Mr. Johnson?
Ms. York's organization, the Minnesota Touch Movement Network, has on its website, which I happened to look at today as I was preparing to come and speak with you, a code of ethics which says, among other things, no member will engage in sexual contact with a client, engage in any verbal behavior that is seductive or sexually demeaning to a client, or engage in sexual exploitation of a client. It's curious to me that it doesn't address former client if this is really such a significant problem.
Hmm. Okay. Well, Ms. York?
I fancy to that. Our members comply with the complementary and alternative health care practice, and I'm grateful to have that pointed out. We will change that, and it will include this language. In fact, before we passed this bill, the MTMN did amend their ethical statements to be basically ahead of where this law was before it even was passed. And I, with all due apology, we neglected to update ours because we adopted this.
Thank you. All right. Well, I guess I'll leave this at the will of the committee. And unless we have additional testimony, we're going to proceed to a vote on this. We're sending this to Health Minister.
No.
I move this bill to pass and be recommended to send to Health Human Service Policy as amended. Those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay.
Thank you.
Bill passes. Thank you. Thank you for coming. I'm next. I was waiting for somebody to go out.
Representative Tao, would you like to move your bill?
Madam Chair, I want to move 3592, House File 3592, to Health Human Service Policy. Took a while because I was waiting for the representative to come testify. I was waiting for myself. So I
Okay, you can go ahead.
Okay. I forgot I was supposed to present. Madam Chair, members, I've been working on this piece of legislation for a while. Originally, I think it was Representative Rood and myself. We were both interested in this field, and I think essentially we're just that this bill will create a registry and eventually certification for interpreters for medical services only. I know people who have used interpreters. Currently, if you want to be a medical interpreter and you say you speak a certain language, you could get employed or get hired and tomorrow end up in the ER without any qualification at all. And many times you have great interpreters, and other times you have those who might not be as ethical or even understand some of the medical terms, be able to translate medical terms to the native language that they speak. And there is truly a concern about quality for interpreting. And with the Representative Rood's bill and my bill going forward last year, there was
the idea of how do we fund them. I think currently the state is on medical assistance. The state does fund medical interpreters. Other than that, if you have private insurance, the health plan does not. And so there's also a discussion of whether we should include that as well. And so essentially that's the bill. There's a provision in here that takes some money from the Health Care Access Fund. Well, not really. Ms. Commit, like to explain a little bit better on the funding mechanism that's in this proposal. And she could get a executive summary of what happened over the summer.
Sure. Go ahead, Ms.
I'd be happy to do that. Thank you, members. My name is Catherine Commit. I'm the representing the Minnesota Council of Health Plans, but as Representative Powell also mentioned, I served on the Interpreter Service Work Group panel that met over the summer and into fall and winter this past year. That work group came about as a result of the legislation that was considered last year, and there was discussion about, clearly everyone agrees that there's a need to find a way for well-qualified interpreter services to be available for anyone who needs interpreter services. And today that's not happening, and we recognize that that is a problem and needs to be addressed. There was legislation that passed that was considered last year. However, the governor's office has been very clear in their message to the proponents of this legislation that they will veto the bill, and in fact did veto the Health and Human Services Omnibus Bill last year, and one of the reasons was because of the requirement to have interpreter services be paid for through the health plans. The issue of interpreter services is a requirement that's on the provider. It's as a result of Title VI, which is part of the Federal Civil Rights Act, and healthcare providers who are the recipients of federal funds have a legal obligation to take reasonable steps to ensure meaningful access to their programs and or activities by limited English proficient patients without undue delay and at no charge. So we would argue that this is a function that is required by the providers. What we've tried to do here, well, over the summer and fall when we met in this work group, we tried to identify what are all the issues and what are all the problems. And clearly there's a big problem with quality, and that's why we're here before this group tonight, is to talk about how could we establish a registry, a roster and a registry, and eventually a certification system that would begin to address the quality issues so that we could have a higher quality of interpreter services available for all persons who have limited English proficiency. As Representative Powell mentioned, there's also some language in the bill that I will admit is controversial, that talks about how to fund this type of a system. And one of the reasons it's controversial is because it's because of federal ERISA laws, which I don't know if anybody wants to get into that, but it's very difficult to impose a mandate at the state level because you can't get everybody to pay for it. I admit that this particular funding source is controversial, but we wanted to try to find a way beyond just trying to pass a mandate that would reach such a small portion of the overall market, but instead find something that would address the funding for everybody in the state, including those persons who are covered under self-funded plans, large self-funded employers, as well as the uninsured, as well as people covered in the commercial insurance. But it would be a system that would cover limited or spoken language interpreter services for everyone. So I feel like the discussion that we should be having in this committee is really about establishing this registry and the what it would take to build a system that would begin the process of a sort of professionalizing this type of profession, because there are some really good interpreters out there, and they deserve to be paid for the work that they've done, the training that they've done, and there are also a few bad actors out there, and clearly we need to find ways to avoid using those folks and instead focus on the people who have clearly devoted their time and effort to make this a lifelong profession for themselves. And it helps in many ways to have interpretive services for the patients, of course. And I do have a few other people with me who would like to speak a little bit about the quality aspect, and if that's okay, we could turn it over to them and let them make a few comments about that. And then a few interpreters who are here today to talk a little bit about what their actual experience is like. So,
Before you do that, you can go ahead and bring them up. I have a question for Rufus Tao or for staff. In terms of the comments you just made about Gilmore Licensing Committee, that we're really focusing a great deal on the quality certification aspect of this, could you explain to me, since there's this tax component of this, I mean, what kind of a sequence for this bill will be?
Well, it should go to Health and Human Services Policy,
and then Health and Human Services Finance. Just clarification. And then, go ahead. And will you, and whoever is next, would you introduce yourself for the tape?
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Carol Berg, and I'm the current chair of the Interpreting Stakeholder Group. And you have a handout, a PowerPoint handout, that I will be going through to just make these brief comments to you. So it's the handout called Bridging the Language Gap, Interpreting Stakeholder Group, March 3rd, 2008. So I will simply be, in the next few minutes, giving you a little bit of background about the stance of the Interpreting Stakeholder Group and why we support the establishment of the statewide interpreter registry for healthcare interpreters, spoken language interpreters. So just to indicate to you, we have a stakeholder group that's been meeting called the ISG. We began meeting under the Upper Midwest Translators and Interpreters Association, UMTSA is the acronym, since January 2004. And our mission is, as a cross-sector collaborative, to cooperatively improve the delivery of spoken language interpreter services across Minnesota and to promote the professionalization of interpreters, or spoken language interpreters, in this state. The second page gives you a list of the ISG members to give you a sense of how broad representation we have on the ISG. You see that we've got people involved in this stakeholder group that are interpreters themselves, those who are training interpreters, interpreter service agencies, healthcare organizations. I come from UCARE. I am a public health manager with UCARE, and we utilize a big network of interpreter service agencies, other healthcare organizations, human service organizations, and state agencies, as you see listed there, as well as area health education centers from rural Minnesota and the Minnesota Supreme Court. Just by way of taking sure we're on the same page regarding a definition of what we're talking about here, I have a slide of the definition of the role of the interpreter that comes from the Minnesota Interpreter Standards Advisory Committee that published a report called Bridging the Language Gap in 1998. And they defined this role as making it possible for two or more individuals who do not share a common language to communicate directly with each other as if they did speak a common language. The next page, I wanted to include just a slide to say that we could talk a lot about the mandates that require us to provide interpreter services. There's the federal law that was already mentioned, the Title VI. There are also a number of Minnesota statutes that require interpreter services for limited English proficient clients. There are also accreditation mandates for healthcare organizations to provide interpreter services. But also there are financial reasons, quality reasons, and demographic reasons for why we should be providing interpreter services. And so I'll go into a few of those examples in the next slide. To begin with, the demographics. The next slide talks about the, again, this is old data, but from the 2000 census, that indicated in Minnesota that 8.5% of homes indicated they were speaking other languages other than English. And then it gives you the breakdown of those particular language groups that are most commonly cited. And I know that that has only increased since the 2000 census was taken. The next slide talks about the impact of not, or I should say on page 4, the patients with language barriers, there are many research studies that show that there are many aspects of what happens when people do not have access to interpreters, when they have a language barrier. And you see some of those reasons listed here that cited in research, that the LAP is acronym for limited English proficient patients. They're less satisfied with the care they receive. They make fewer visits and receive fewer preventive services. They're less likely to use and return to the clinics for appropriate care. They score lower on their health knowledge and understanding of their diagnosis and treatment. They have longer hospital stays. And the next slide talks about the critical role of language services. Again, more research, and we could go into many others, but I'm just citing a few here in these next few slides. That LAP patients are less likely to have a regular source of ongoing care if they do not have interpreter services. And they're more likely to report overall problems with the care that they do receive when they get access to care. And that they are more at risk of experiencing medical errors without the assistance of interpreter services. And so I would want to point out in the next slide on page 5, the impact of not using interpreters. LAP patients who need but do not receive interpreter services, they have more tests done, creating a higher overall cost to the health system. They're more likely to receive intravenous hydration and to be admitted to the hospital without that assistance. And they're at greater risk of being discharged from the emergency department without a follow-up appointment. In contrast, research that measures when people do have access to trained interpreters, they have the following. They have a decrease in utilization disparities for outpatient preventive services. There's a reduction in the return to the ER and referral rates. And there's a low admission rate from the emergency room to be hospitalized if they have appropriate trained interpreters working for them. And so that's just briefly highlighting a few research studies that indicate the importance of interpreter services. So in summary, on page 6, I take from, again, the interpreter service workgroup report that Catherine Schmidt mentioned just a minute ago. I also served on that to represent the ISG, where the research indicates that using a trained interpreter can increase patients and provider satisfaction. It increased the patient's perceived understanding of their care. It improves patient primary care utilization and improves the patient's health outcomes. And using trained interpreters may reduce cost of complications and lower the cost of care in the long run. And so improving interpretive services is really important to those of us who are working on this interpreting stakeholder group. We are currently working on the three priorities that you see listed in the next slide on page 6, that we're coordinating the training efforts that are happening throughout Minnesota. We have been able to receive funding from a couple of foundations, Bush and Bremer foundations, to help us support more training sessions to make sure anybody working in this capacity is receiving professional training. A second priority is that we're partnering with other states to establish a healthcare interpreter certification process, which does not yet exist in Minnesota, and that we're assisting with the development of a spoken language healthcare interpreter registry. We already have a work group that is working on specifications for this, and we are working with California Health Interpreter Association, CIA, to hopefully build on the software that they have for an interpreter registry and to adapt that for Minnesota. The next page, just again to remind everyone that as part of promoting interpreter training throughout Minnesota, in the training we are making sure people are able to follow, and, well, first of all, learn about the code of ethics, the professional code of ethics that you see listed in this slide from the National Council on Interpreting in Healthcare. And then also the next slide talks about 32 standards that guide the training of interpreters, the practice standards. There are 32 standards that fall under these 9 categories that, again, have been published and agreed upon at the national level through the NCIHC. And page 8 mentions the certification work that's going on. This is just a definition of what we are talking about as far as wanting to certify interpreters, that this needs to be done by a distinct entity that would oversee the certification process, and that we are looking at how it's done in other states as well as how the Minnesota state court system is doing it, even though the court system does not test for proficiency at this point. and want to acknowledge that Dr. Bruce Downing is our liaison through the ISD to connect with the National Council on Interpreting and Healthcare to cooperate with other states in developing these exams and the steps needed to establish a certification process. And so to summarize, I would just want to say that the ISD really does want to see established a statewide registry of spoken language interpreters working in healthcare, and this would help us to, as the slide on page 9 indicates, it would help us to establish a baseline of who are the interpreters in Minnesota. Right now, we do not know who they are and where they're working. We have a sense because of those working through interpreter agencies, those who have been trained through the University of Minnesota program, but we need a better baseline of who they are and where they're serving. It would also assist us to identify the gaps in availability of trained interpreters. It would allow us to improve our communication about training opportunities to those in the database that haven't been professionally trained yet, and to help locate interpreters to arrange for interpreter services. Many times it's a struggle, especially for smaller number language groups, to find appropriate interpreters for them. And so we support, the last slide there is to support this registry development. And as you see stated there, this is exactly what we recommended through the Interpreter Services Work Group report to the legislature that was just submitted in February, that the statewide registry would require fulfillment of education and training requirements, that there would be a demonstration of language proficiency, that there would be the interpreter in the registry would agree to abide by the code of ethics, and that there would be a listing in the registry of the results of a criminal background check. These were the minimum criteria that we would want to see in the registry. And then I just give you my contact information if there are any other questions, or I would be happy to follow up with any issues that might arise out of our discussion.
Thank you, Ms. Bird. And Dr. Downing, introduce yourself to the mic for the tape.
Yes, I'm Bruce Downing, and I'm Director of the Program in Translation and Interpreting at the University of Minnesota. Excuse me, I'm losing my voice. And I'm a member of the Standards Training and Certification Committee of the National Council on Interpreting and Healthcare, which Carol referred to. She did such a good job of going over all this territory that I don't really need to add a lot, but I want to add a couple of things from my personal point of view. And addressing the issue of setting standards for qualifications of interpreters, I'm not knowledgeable, or I'm not going to try to address the funding issue. I'm a professional linguist in the linguistics department at the university. In the 1980s, I was involved in research with refugees, and in 1985, we received a contract for a refugee mental health technical assistance center at the university, and it was through that that I really became aware of the difficult problem of communication between different languages and cultures when you're dealing with mental health, but also with healthcare in general, with things like mental, special education assessments in the schools. There's so many areas where communication is really important, but I think generally it's hard to recognize how difficult it is. And some people have said that interpreting, especially simultaneous interpreting, but any kind of interpreting, is one of the most difficult kind of intellectual activities that anyone has to do, to try to find how meaning in one language expressed through the words and sentences of that language can be conveyed in another language. It's, you know, if you look at a bilingual dictionary and you see one word matched up with another word as if there was just a one-to-one correlation, it looks fairly easy. But that's not what's involved in interpreting. You may know all the words in one language and the words in the other language, but to get the meaning across of a message that someone's trying to convey, either the patient expressing their symptoms and their history, or the professional trying to explain what the illness is and how it's going to be treated and what the risks are and all of that, it's extremely difficult and yet critically important. So I really sort of personally become dedicated to try to improve this. I moved from working just in linguistics to establishing a program to train interpreters, and we've had support in the training from state governments and the federal refugee program, from local foundations. So we think we have a pretty good program at the university, but not everybody has that access to it. And the problem is that even people who are trained are out there working as interpreters and competing with people who are totally untrained because there are no standards set in the field. So all these differences that the research shows, Carol talked about research showing the great advantages of having trained interpreters who have developed their interpreting skills versus having people who are unaware of the ethical standards, who violate ethical standards, who are not capable of achieving the accuracy. Training is important because interpreting is a skill. It's not just knowledge, but it's a skill. Being able to speak immediately when someone has spoken and express what they've said. It's a kind of skill like athletics and artistic expression and so on that requires practice over many years, and really practice in a kind of laboratory setting where you can develop your skills. So the big need is to have some way of bringing up the profession by providing opportunities for training and then recognizing those who have training in distinction from those who do not. Now, one thing I want to emphasize here is just the distinction. We're in the bill, we're talking about a roster, a registry, and certification. And those may sound like the same thing. But the roster, the purpose of the roster is just to have a listing so we know who's out there doing interpreting. And people who need interpreters, the organizations that need interpreters, will be able to go to the roster and find someone who can interpret. But that's just a kind of finder tool. It helps us reach those people and introduce them to standards. A registry is defined sort of professionally as a way of identifying people who have certain qualifications. And so we can establish qualifications such as training, adherence to a code of ethics, and so on, for a registry and give recognition to those who are specially qualified. We can't require at this point that everybody who needs an interpreter use interpreters on the registry, because there just won't be that many people who would qualify. But we can ask people to give preference to those who are qualified, and health organizations thinking about providing good service and concerned about liability are likely to want to choose those people who are on the registry. At this point, they have no systematic way of finding out who's more qualified than someone else. Now, certification, by definition, means that you have testing that is adequate to tell who can do the job that you're certified for and who cannot. There's some kind of passing score. But it has to be done through testing at the level that you have a criterion that this is what interpreters ideally need to be able to do, and these are the people who can do it because they demonstrate it through passing the test. Personally, I don't think that certification can be done state by state. For the state courts, there's a consortium that includes now Minnesota was one of the four initial members of the consortium, but now there's something like 36 states that share testing for certification. I think we ought to be cooperating eventually with certification, but I don't think we ought to try to tackle certification at the cost of a test in every language that's involved at this point. What we need in the meantime is a registry that sets some kind of minimal qualifications for interpreters who have met what we consider minimal qualifications. I've made up a list of things that some small things that I'd like to change in the wording of the bill, which I'm not going to present now, but we'll bring in later. But one thing that would be consistent with what the work group did over the last year, there was a recommendation that a working group be set up to advise whoever administers the registry as to what the qualifications should be. We have groups who are working on that already. The bill talks about an advisory committee to the Department of Health, but it attaches it to certification. I think it should be attached to deciding what the qualification should be for the registry, so we can get something in place with as wide a participation in that as possible. I think I'll stop there and any questions? Thank you.
Mr. Hill.
Madam Chair, I did receive Dr. Browning's email as well, and because we drafted this bill so early, so late in the process, we need to get through the committing process that the intention was we were going to have to delete all to fix a lot of the issues that Dr. Browning brought up. And so I commit to the committee that we're going to work with Dr. Browning and the stakeholders group to get an amendment before it gets to, when it gets to the health policy committee. Yep. So.
Thank you. We're going to take a question or two now. Representative Norton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, I'm especially pleased, and I know there's more testifiers, so maybe we'll hear a little bit more about this. I'm very pleased that this has come forward, and I had the pleasure of attending an event that the Mayor Humanities Speaker Series put on this past year, and it was a remarkable documentary called Hold Your Breath. That particular documentary talked a lot about cultural influence, decision-making, information shared at the time of an office visit, and it particularly was pointing to familial interpretation or friend interpretation, which many families use. And so as we move forward with this, I found that particular documentary troubling in many respects because of cultural differences, because of family influence. Sometimes the patient isn't getting the whole story because someone's trying to protect them, or there's certain terminologies that aren't used by this particular gentleman had stomach cancer. The term cancer was never interpreted for the patient, although he did figure it out somewhere along the line. The familial and friend interpretation should be the exception and not the rule, and that somehow as we move forward with this, we move forward to professional, as this registry grows, that we move forward to something that is required as opposed to, you know, I guess second choice, but it would be the first and major way. And we haven't gotten to the, so I guess I'm looking for, are we starting here and planning on moving forward so that we have a registry that's required for reimbursement, that might be what we would move to? And then second, the piece we haven't gotten to that's most troubling about this bill, because I love the intent, which is the funding of it, and I assume at some point we're gonna get to that in the testimony. But could someone just address the requirement for professional interpreters and reimbursement, and how that might work eventually?
Madam Chair, members, the intention, my intention anyway, is to slowly move into a quality sector where you want to get quality services for folks going to the hospital. So that eventually maybe I would like to end up seeing certification, or even what do we do for the naturopath? The, what was that term? The what do we do? Re-register them. Yeah. Eventually I would like to get to a certain level, maybe with the funding. I know that's the controversial piece of it. I would like for us maybe we discuss the quality stuff and what's in our scope of practice, but I leave it up to the committee as well. We'll wait till we get to finance to discuss the funding piece. That's probably more appropriate.
Yes, if I might, Madam Chair, about certification, there's a lot of pressure across the country for certification because payers want to know what they're getting, and this research shows the value of having well-qualified interpreters, and so a lot of people want to get there as soon as possible. It's a fairly complicated process, but one thing I wanted to add to what I already said is that the National Council on Interpreting and Healthcare, having established a code of ethics that's embedded nationally and a standard of practice, is moving on to think about certification, and we want to make it a broader process. So funding has been obtained from the National Foundation by the National Council to establish a sort of umbrella organization looking at certification. It includes the American Translators Association, the Massachusetts Medical Interpreters Association, California Medical Interpreters Association, and they set up a mechanism to get other states involved in pushing this forward cooperatively on a national basis. So that mechanism is in process, and my personal belief is that that's the way we need to do it, to set up a process for certification, to decide what the test should have, who should design the test to make it reliable, where it should be administered nationally, and then for the states to buy into certifying in each state those people who have passed the national test.
Thank you.
I have a question in the Norton brought the issue. I think the quality issue is very important. I agree. I'm glad this is coming forward. I had questions and concerns about the supply issue, whether or not we will actually have enough people in each of these language areas to, within a relatively reasonable amount of time, or by 2012 or shortly after, have them be able to be certified and meet the need that's out there. So one is a comment in terms of this, or end question, I guess, in terms of this this working group, in terms of when you get this information of have this roster and then a registry, are you also collecting information, or does it already exist in our system, on what the demand has been out there for each of the different language categories? You know, how much reimbursement is occurring for each of the different language categories, or the demand for it, so we know once we see that roster where we have areas that we're going to have difficulty in eventually meeting certification of enough interpreters.
Manager, the report from the working group tried to address that, but it's very difficult to get information about how much is actually being spent, what the demand is, how many people are interpreting, and so on. The roster would at least help in getting some of the information we need. Who is doing interpreting? Do they do it full-time or part-time, or are they paid or unpaid volunteers? Are they family members? We need to find that out. As far as who might meet the qualification for the roster, suppose we said that people need to have so many hours of training. We've had training at the University of Minnesota through this program since 1991. There are a few hundred people who have met sort of minimal educational qualifications. There are a couple of hundred people who have completed the certificate in interpreting. That requires 6 university courses. Century College is just searching to hire a full-time person to start an interpreter training program there. We've done training in Wilmer and Crookston and Mankato currently, and Worthington through the funding that we got from the Bush Foundation this year. So there are a number of people already coming up. We sort of have the training, but not everybody has the incentive to take the training, and we'll never have all the people for all the different languages trained at that level, but having the roster would be a start.
Madam Chair, I don't know the full numbers for all the interpreting services. I think for the state portion, for folks who are on medical assistance and stuff, I think the state puts in about $15 million.
Mm-hmm. My question was really aimed at, and actually I have a more basic question now, given your answer, was really aimed at if we get this list of individuals who do interpreting, how do we know how that stacks up the future demand for various languages and whether we're going to have enough, you know, adequately trained people in each of those areas? And I think I'm hearing that maybe folks that come up later may address this too, that we really don't know, have good data on how much interpreting is currently being used in which languages, like by the half hour throughout the medical system. It sounds like maybe we don't know that. More basic to me and is, does that mean currently we are reimbursing for, whether in the public or private, for interpreter services where we don't have any knowledge of the qualifications of that interpreter? I mean, if there is no roster currently, how do providers and hospitals even find these interpreters? I guess. So two basic questions. How are they found if there's no existing roster? And, just real basic.
Those of us who are obligated, you know, health plans, I'll just speak from our perspective. We do our best to try to do, for instance, UCARE did a request for proposals for interpreter services, and we use particular criteria that have been used by other healthcare organizations to do a review of all the translation service agencies before we contract with them. Mm-hmm. And they assure us that they're doing these minimum procedures for screening before they hire interpreters. But then it's not verified often, though. You know, the training that someone will say that they have had as an interpreter, we can't really verify what's been done. And so many people are saying that they have been trained professionally or that they're certified, but they only have a certificate of attendance, let's say, for 20 hours of classes on interpreter training. Mm-hmm. And so there's such variation in what people are stating as far as what their training is. There's some that have excellent training and others that don't. And so it's really difficult to verify that training. And then as far as, we do have a slice of the picture of what languages are most needed. You could get statistics, we could provide that for what's being covered for public programs through health plans, as well as what's done through hospital interpreter service programs. They have statistics on the most needed languages and what are the hardest languages to get interpreters for when it's for a smaller population. So we can share that.
Thank you. And you might say, because you might go answer this one too, one more question, we'll move on to the other. I'm not sure I'm clear. Oftentimes on this committee, when we talk about certification, maybe I'm wrong, you can correct me, that often means those are the only people that can do that thing, I thought. But maybe I'm wrong. Maybe that's just licensing. And therefore, my question is, is there at some point where providers and hospitals are only going to be able to use people who are certified or on the registry or on the roster, or that's just going to give them information about who they might like to use, but they're not required to use?
I represent, Madam Chair, I believe that's our ability as the legislature to decide in that whether we want to go that direction or not. So
that'll have to be sequential. Could I just say that I don't think we can require that at this time. We're going to have to see what, the availability, the pool of interpreters is by creating the roster first and then the registry of those who have that next level of professional training before we could go to the next steps of requiring that certain level of interpreter training.
So just to be clear, the word certification here is not to indicate they are the only people who are going to be allowed to do that. So,
okay. Correct.
Okay, and we'll move on to the next testifier, and I'll let you pronounce your own name.
Oh,
thank you for coming.
Thank you, Representative and members of the committee. My name is Jose Gonzalez. I am an immigrant from Mexico, and I was already speaking Spanish when I was brought to the U.S. at the age of 3. Once here, my parents instituted a rule in our home. We weren't allowed to speak English in the home unless there was someone who could not understand Spanish. This rule was primarily intended to develop and sustain our Spanish-speaking skills. However, it was also explicitly stated that this rule was intended to be respectful of guests in our home. This rule allowed me to read and write Spanish fluently. I was the first person in our home to learn to speak English. By the time I was entering the first grade, I was already the designated family interpreter for all health, business, and consumer transactions. That was almost 45 years ago, so I was placed in horrible, horrible positions. And second line translating of horrible things I heard people say of my parents, but I didn't translate or interpret directly to my parents. Since then, I have attained a bachelor's degree in psychology and a master's degree in social work from the University of Minnesota. I have almost 30 years of experience in helping various populations of all age groups get their needs met, especially populations with limited English speaking proficiency. More recently, I was the former public health clinic social work supervisor and manager of the interpreter program for the city of Minneapolis. I also was an original member of the Interpreter Standards Advisory Committee that in 1998 produced a report titled Bridging the Language Gap. This produced recommendations for training, certification, and use of foreign language interpreters. If nothing else, I hope my testimony helps you committee members understand that my personal and professional experience and skills do not, I repeat, do not make me a qualified interpreter. I believe I was a very good Spanish-speaking social worker, but never for one second did I believe I could responsibly interpret for the nurses, nurse practitioners, nurse midwives, or doctors in our public health clinics. I was never trained on interpreting skills or ethics. Two, I was never trained on medical terminology. I do not know the Spanish words for uterus or urethra, but I'm sure knowing so makes a world of difference to both the patient and the medical provider for many health and legal reasons. Without having well-trained interpreters, patients do not know if their health concerns are being adequately conveyed to medical providers. and medical providers have no way of knowing if their diagnostic questions are being conveyed or answered correctly, or if their treatment plans and medication instructions are being interpreted safely. This is dangerous. A registry of trained interpreters whose training in English foreign language skills as well, not just their English, but also their foreign language skills, have already been scrutinized and through established standards and curricula. This would be a huge resource to the providers. On the community side, unfortunately, there are many stories of predators that force new immigrants and refugees to use their interpretive translating or transportation services and pay outrageous prices, never sharing the fact if they are already being reimbursed for their services. This happens more often than we are made aware of. Many interpreters pass themselves off as certified interpreters, and as you've heard, there's no such animal right now. We also have interpreter owners who have interpreting services who fail to pay or pay their interpreters poorly. We've heard many of that while I was working in public health clinics. I just want to mention that in the past century, there have been many public health achievements that contributed greatly to overall health improvements. Examples include vaccinations, motor vehicle safety, things like airbags and seatbelts, fluoridation of drinking water, recognition of tobacco use as a health hazard. Public health and philanthropy contributed greatly to the research and data collection that justified legislative and policy change to support all the necessary infrastructure changes and the financial means to maintain these changes. But at some point, it fell on the legislators to take the next step. Public health education will only take you so far. At some point, you had to have something like the Clean Indoor Act and other things. City of Minneapolis, isn't it nice to go into a bar now these days? The leadership of people like Dr. Bruce Downing and Carol Berg and others has got us this far. The state of Minnesota needs for you to take that critical next step in taking what we have already learned to reduce our state's health disparities and all our residents. And again, I'm speaking right now as a, I believe, a good bilingual, bicultural person that in no way should ever pass myself off as an interpreter. I also want to state that my day job is currently, as I've been working for 8 years, with the Bush Foundation. While I value the work that Dr. Downing has been doing at the University of Minnesota, one of our other tasks has been to make this training and curriculum more available, especially in greater Minnesota. So we've been working now with Century College and other MinSCU people to make this training more available and to get all those people that hopefully at some point will have a good collection of registry. I should also mention another approach to all of this is the fact that we have some beautiful, incredible number of immigrants that are coming to the state of Minnesota right now. Many of them are healthcare professionals. They're already nurses and nurse practitioners and doctors. So the other approach is how do we get them to attain their licensure to practice here in the state of Minnesota. At some point, there may even be less need for a lot of these services. It goes to your, you know, what will the need be? And I think there's other approaches that we're also looking into, and hopefully we'll have enough information for you in the future. So I'll stop right there. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Gondola. And go ahead, Ms. Duan.
Yeah, Kang Duan. Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Kang Duan, and I'm the Interpreter Service Manager for Hennepin County Medical Center. And I just want to say that I fully support the proposed Bill 3592 because it reflects the interests of healthcare institutions such as ours, healthcare providers, as well as the best interests of recipients of healthcare, which is the patient. Because this bill would ensure a statewide high standard for spoken language in healthcare. So it is very important that we establish a registry of and certification of healthcare interpreter services. And I just want to answer some of the question I heard previously. Regarding our hospital, the top four highest demand language that we serve is Spanish is number one, Somali is number two, and third is Hmong, and then followed by Russian and then other languages. In 2006, for patient contact, we saw 110,000. Last year, 2007, we saw 120,000. So as you can see, there's a significant number of entries. So with that, I just want you to know that I fully support this bill. Thank you.
And I don't know if Val, and this is the one I didn't want to... Are you Val?
Yes.
That's one of the last name I didn't want to butcher, so please introduce yourself to the tape.
My name is Val Shudlowski. I'm a senior instructor at HCMC, Hamilton County Medical Center. And I've been working with at the HCMC for the past 10 years. I know that myself, as well as all the other professional interpreters that we have on board, we have about 60 staff interpreters at HCMC. We are looking forward to this bill, as I have also met other healthcare interpreters around the country, be it in Boston or elsewhere, mm-hmm. who are also looking to this, because we want to make sure that our profession is a professional profession, that we are recognized as professionals, that we can deliver the health, this kind of service, mm-hmm. Knowing that we are protected from those who are less ethically inclined, and there are other issues involved here as well. There are issues of liability, because mm-hmm. the hospital carries mm-hmm. the liability for the performance of the interpreters. So it is a very vital situation. If everything's fine as long as nothing happens. But when something happens, then you have the lawsuit, and then it is much more costly to explain. I when my kids were growing up, I had a little thing on the refrigerator which said it takes less time to do a thing right than to explain why you didn't. And they always smiled when I just looked at them, you know. But anyway, this is the essence. Interpreting is, as Dr. Browning and Ms. Carol Berg have indicated, of course, it's much more involved than just translating from one word and another word. It is much more too complex to go into here. Mm-hmm. And I hope you appreciate this issue. There are things which, when you have a professional interpreter, and this is a trust relationship in an encounter between the LEP patient and the professional. Mm-hmm. And we have a truly trust relationship, because the interpreter is so often the only individual who knows what's going on, because if the provider doesn't speak the language of the recipient, the patient, and the patient doesn't understand, then truly you are at the mm-hmm. mercy, if you wish, and hopefully you never you would never be at that kind of a position. But you are, the pivoting point is the interpreter, who has to be trusted by both. This is very important. This is the same kind of relationship that you have between the provider and the patient, but it is also the same kind of relationship where the provider and the patient cannot speak the same language, so you have to have this intermediate. I know that our doctors who have been exposed to working with patients, LEP patients, limited English proficient patients, they would support this bill very much so, because they're doing this at the University of Minnesota. We've been working with them, and they are the ones who have been supporting us also last year when we had a conference here in the Twin Cities, mm-hmm. where we had professionals from all over the world, all over the country, forgive me, not yet from all over the world, mm-hmm. but from all over the country, who came together, and we are looking forward to something that would be on a state level, at least here, that we would be able to have standards for professional interpreters mm-hmm. right here. Mm-hmm. So I beg you, mm-hmm. please consider it and support it.
Thank you, Mr. Wodowski. And Ms. Dewan, thank you. Susan Boynes in the room.
Good evening, Madam Chair, members of the committee, Representative Chow. Thank you for sponsoring this bill. I want to thank all my colleagues in the spoken language interpreting field tonight for coming and sharing their testimony mm-hmm. with you.
I'm a sign language interpreter. I'm certified. I've been certified for 25 years. I'm part of the Minnesota Registry of Interpreters for the Deaf and the National Registry for the Deaf of Interpreters for the Deaf.
Please, your name, please. Thank you.
I beg your pardon. My name is Susan Buena.
Thank you.
And I just want to say it can be done. It's a long road towards creating a certification and the credentialing process, the register, the roster process, but it can be done, and we're here to lend a hand to the brothers and sisters of spoken language communities. The National Council of Healthcare Interpreters Code of Ethics was written with the help of sign language interpreters, although it doesn't pertain to us. It's written specifically for spoken language interpreters. And I just would like to make sure that you all keep in mind that spoken language interpreters would like to come into the same kinds of jurisdiction, roster, requirements for certification, yet separate, because we are 30 years ahead. We already have some of these things in place. We also have in the Twin Cities a settlement supported by the Department of Justice in several hospital systems requiring certified interpreters of a certain level and above be present for providing sign language interpreting services because of these kinds of problems that the spoken language interpreters have mentioned happen and arise when they aren't certified. Thank you very much for hearing us.
Thank you very much, Ms. Buena. And Mr. Renner. Thank you for coming and introduce yourself.
Madam Chair, members, my name is Dave Renner, representing the Minnesota Medical Association. Thank you for the chance to make some comments. I know we have talked to each of you over the last 2 to 3 years on the importance of this issue of medical interpreters and the importance of not only how do we pay for medical interpreters, but also the issues of quality and some minimum standards. I have read there. I also had the pleasure of serving on the work group that met over this interim and spring and fall. And I will say that there was near unanimity agreement on the development of a registry. And from the Medical Association, we also agree. And I think that's what you heard most of the discussion tonight has been on Section 1 of this legislation, which we would support as well. When we talk with our physician members, they have a lot of the same horror stories you've heard tonight about the inability to be able to communicate, the inappropriateness of using family members, and the need to ensure that we have high-quality interpreters. So we have strong support for Section 1 of this bill. In the work group that met over the interim, there was absolutely no consensus over Sections 2 through 5 of this bill, and that's how to pay for medical interpreters. Matter of fact, many of you had the opportunity to hear the Representative Rood, which Representative Powell has also worked on, made reference to last year, her legislation, which is still alive, which would talk about another potential funding source. While I've heard some say this is not the committee to talk about that, I do have to strongly say that we would strongly support those sections and encourage them not to be a part of this legislation at this time. It is very hard for us to get our membership excited about something which we think is important when there is the funding source that's attached here. In addition to talking to you about medical interpreters over the last year, we've also talked to you about the issues of integrity of the Healthcare Access Fund. It is, while, as you all are aware, physicians do not like paying the provider tax, we have at least come to the agreement or acknowledgement that if it's going to be here, it should be used for what it was intended, and it should not become the healthcare slush fund. And that's the fear that we have with this funding source, that this is not what was originally intended for, and it will be now be used to fund a new program. I think the discussion that you come down to over the funding is what's the role of the Healthcare Access Fund, which historically has been for providing coverage to low-income Minnesotans, versus what's the role of insurance companies to cover services related to healthcare, which I would argue the ability to communicate in those meetings with your healthcare provider should be a covered service. So I'm not sure if we want to get into that discussion tonight, but we would strongly encourage before the bill moves out of this committee that Sections 2 through 5 not be included in it. I should also just clarify for the record, Ms. Smith indicated earlier that the governor vetoed the Health and Human Services bill last year because this was in the bill. That is not true. What was included in the final Health and Human Services bill last year was just creation of the study group. The language dealing with who pays for house funded was taken out of that bill before it went to the governor. I'd be happy to answer any questions that we may have.
Thank you, Mr. Renner.
Madam Chair, I'm sorry.
Go ahead,
Representative
Hamilton.
I'd run and grab some
water and a cough drop here. I apologize. One more time, your explanation to remove section 225, please.
Our concern is just that section 225 talks about using the health care access fund to pay for interpreter services. Our argument, again, we have argued strongly that the health care access fund provides protected integrity of that fund and not use it for funding for new programs. Now, the way it's drafted as a way that it would be a tax credit to the fund, but the reality of it would be less money that would be coming out of the health care access fund to help pay for those services.
Member, did you address that question?
Well, to that question, Representative Bunn and Representative Hamilton, the problem with the funding source that we've been discussing over the past 2 years is that it would simply require that the health plans, it would mandate that the health plans pay for the cost of interpreter services. And we can do that, but it really only reaches a small portion of the market. It only affects the fully insured market. And this issue of people who have limited English proficiency is a statewide issue. There are many people who work for self-funded companies who would not be impacted by this mandate. There are people who are uninsured who should also have the same kinds of protections for and access to interpreter services. Dave Renner and I respectfully disagree about the using the Healthcare Access Fund as a funding source. We think this is an issue of access, but and I recognize this is a controversial funding mechanism. I would just respectfully ask the committee members to set that issue aside and simply focus on the first part of the bill on the quality piece, because that is your jurisdiction, and let this bill move out of this committee intact so that we can continue to have the discussion about what is the appropriate funding source. Perhaps it's not the Health Care Access Fund, perhaps it should be the income tax, perhaps it's something else. But nevertheless, I would just like the committee to allow this to go forward so that we could continue to have that discussion in the Finance Committee where those issues are discussed.
Mm-hmm.
If I may, Madam Chair. This committee is correct. We do not agree on this, and we've had many conversations with in front of this committee and also in the halls and elsewhere. I would strongly disagree with her assessment and encourage you not to include this, only because I think everything you heard tonight was related to Section 1, and I think there is strong consensus that we should move forward with Section 1. I can tell you right now from the Medical Association's point of view that if the rest of this bill, the rest of the sections are included in this bill, we cannot support this legislation. Mm-hmm. And it was very difficult for us to go back to our membership and say, okay, you've been asking us to help support the integrity of the Health Care Access Fund, but here's a new funding source that was never what was the Health Care Access Fund was originally intended for. Mm-hmm. I think if we have consensus that Section 1 is important, which is what I heard tonight, I would strongly encourage you to let's move that portion forward and not get bogged down in discussion how it would be.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Just for clarification, I want to make a couple some comments, and you can correct me if I'm wrong. Just for clarification on this term funding source. First of all, interpreter services are currently already funded because it's required by, I believe it's the federal law, that they be provided. So currently they are funded by providers, hospitals and other kinds of providers. So it's not like we're seeking, so they are funded, but it's being funded. So the question is, who should fund in the future and how to fund in the future? So the legislation last year was going to shift that funding from providers to plans, potentially, and then the counter-argument is that, well, when you do mandates on plans in the state, the self-insured are not included, so it's only going to hit this portion of the market, just so that everyone in the room, I'm just going to clarify that. On the issue of the phrase funding source, though, it strikes me that everything in Section 2-5, and again, maybe we'll include, is about reducing providers' health care access tax based on the extent to which they provide interpreter services. And so, but I have a question, a different aspect of funding source. taking a 2-2 if one did not look at Section 225 for a moment, is any appropriation of any kind needed to fund Section 1 of this bill? I mean, because it wasn't clear to me that these dollars or this discussion in Section 2-6, and if you could, because that hasn't been explained to the committee tonight about the funding for Section 1 and where that would come from.
Madam Chair, member,
donated, but not tonight.
I think we are also are asking for some money to do to establish the registry.
Right.
So, other than that, yeah.
Madam Chair, Section 5, as I read that appropriation, that is to create the work group to do the work of the bill. That also, however, comes out of the Health Care Access Fund.
Okay.
So
yeah. Okay.
We would encourage, again, we're not opposed to funding for this, but we just don't think that the Health Care Access Fund should be used for that.
So even, it isn't, this hadn't said, been said publicly tonight, so I wanted people to be on the same page about that. So even doing Section 1 is also talking about funds from the Health Care Access Commission. Okay. And Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a very bouncy microphone today. I had an amendment. I had an amendment drawn on this question that I have here and members have in their folder. And I've been talking with the author of the bill. I'm not sure the amendment as it's drawn is the direction that we want to go. But I do have concerns about the funding source.
Mm-hmm.
And I know the author of the bill also understands there are problems with the funding source. And I was persuaded at the start of the hearing that we should deal with this in finance. Because it is a question, I think, for the finance committee rightfully, but I hear the Medical Association's concerns that they're going to have a hard time supporting the bill, and the registry itself is important. So I guess I would like to urge the author to contemplate options here. I would be willing to move deletions of Section 2, 3, and 4, but I don't want to do that without... I would be willing to do it, but I don't want to do the author.
Madam Chair.
Judge, I'm having an ethical dilemma here.
Madam Chair, member, I leave this at the will of the committee. Not a powerful committee chair, so I think you guys think it's appropriate.
Well, I'm not sure I'm a powerful vice chair, plain chair either, but as I'm new to this, but I think the issue of, obviously we're having very big discussions this year about funding various aspects of healthcare and healthcare reform and healthcare. I think this committee is not probably the place to, I think we all say, are saying that we think what's being suggested in Section 1 absolutely deserves our attention, our support, probably, not least mine, going forward, or most likely would, but that we have to take up the issue of how to fund it in another committee. But Ms. Kimmich, do you want to add?
Madam Chair, I just wanted to say that, again, I recognize this is controversial. I don't want this language in Section 1 to get lost in the bigger budget discussion. I want to keep this language alive to see the implementation of a roster and a registry and eventually a certification system come to fruition, because as you heard the testifiers tonight, this is so important and could go a long way to helping to reduce health disparities and improve overall health care for people who do not speak English as their primary language. So the reason I wanted to leave the funding mechanism sections 2-5 in there is simply to keep it more front and center for the discussion with the other legislators. Otherwise, I'm afraid this is going to fall to the bottom of the list of all of the different demands that you're going to have to discuss during the as we move forward on the budget process.
Mm.
And I do think that this having this language in there provokes some good discussion, and I think we should have that discussion.
Mm. Yeah.
Madam Chair and members,
okay.
Representative Murphy, was that did you move that, or was that just a question or a suggestion? Or
Madam Chair and members, I have not moved that out of respect to the author of the bill.
Ms. Kmet, I just heard your argument, and I would be concerned that it might have just the opposite effect, myself, just my own view on it, that by taking this approach, it might get axed earlier on, and it might be at more risk. So just, I'm not sure that's just my initial reaction on hearing that. So I think that I hope that something like this does go through, and I hope we don't put it at risk because of making it highly controversial when it is merits our, at least in my view, merits my support. So anyone, other questions or a motion? Members of the committee?
Madam Chair.
Yep.
I would like to make an oral amendment and delete sections 2, 3, and 4 from House File 3592 with all respect to the author.
Further discussion of the amendment? Other members of the committee? Comments on the amendment?
No, Madam Chair, I think we had enough.
Okay. I'm deciding what I have to vote on this. Okay. All those in favor of the amendment to delete sections 2 through 4 of House File 3592. Those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? Thank you. The amendment passes. And to the motion,
Madam,
as amended.
I renew House File 3592 be recommended to pass and sent to Health and Service Policy.
Mm-hmm. As amended.
As amended.
Yes. All those in favor of passing House File 3592 to Health and Service Policy as amended, indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? And the bill passed on to Health and Human Services Policy.
Are we allowed to applaud?
Well, if we were in the House floor, the speaker would say no reaction from the gallery. But thank you all for coming and your patience. Thank you. Oh, we are adjourned.